Beruchim, Anim-Saim, ladies, we are studying today Parashat Yitro. Today's shiur is being studied by Nishmat Mordechai ben Norma. Ruach Hashem Tenichenu Began Eden. Amen. Just a few ideas in our Parashah. Our Parashah is called Parashat Yitro. Yitro, of course, was the father-in-law of Moshe Rabbeinu. It says that when he heard about Yisiat Mitzrayim, and when he heard about the war that the Jewish people fought against Amalek, and they won, but Yishma Yitro, he heard these events, and he said that he wants to convert, and he did convert, and he joined the Jewish people. And he brought back Sipporah, that was Moshe Rabbeinu's wife, because Sipporah was living with her father in Midian during the whole Yisiat Mitzrayim. So Yitro brought back Sipporah and Moshe's children, and there was like a reunion. And the Pasuk writes that he accepted upon himself the belief of God. Yitro, you have to know, originally was a priest. He was the priest of Midian. Today we might have called Yitro a pope. He was not Jewish at all. He was not a believer in God even. He believed in Avodah Zarah. But as a result of all the miracles, and he understood it, and it made sense to him, so he says, "Atayadati." He says, now I know, "Ki gadol Hashem mikol ha'Elohim." I know that God is greater than all the gods. So our rabbis tell us, must be worshipped all the gods. Because he was able to compare. He's able to say, oh, now I see God is the best God. That means must be he knew about all the other gods. And he came to the conclusion that God is the emet. Then he says, "Ki badabar asher zadu alehim." What does it mean, "badabar asher zadu alehim"? So he writes over here, Rashi, from the Midrash, "Lashon vayazid Yaakov nazid bekedera asher b'shelu ba nidvashelu." Nazid is a soup. How do you make a soup? Soup, you put it in the pot, you put it under the fire, and you mix it. So the Pasuk says over, I saw, Yitro's talking, how the Egyptians got punished, badavar asher zadu alehim. So that she says, in the pot that they cooked, they got cooked. What does that mean? In the pot that they cooked, they got cooked. God punished them measure for measure. Midah kenegid midah. They drowned the Jewish children in the water. When the Jewish boys were born, one of Paro's decrees was to take the children, to throw them into the water and drown them. And he did it. So God says at a later time in history, all the Egyptians are going to drown as well. So Yitro was smart. He understood there's no coincidences in life. The person gets what he deserves. And therefore Yitro saw that, why did God punish the Egyptians specifically by drowning in the water? They could have died in numerous ways. HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not limited by one way or the other. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have destroyed the Egyptians in any way possible. But Yitro said, there must be a God in the world. The world must be run by divine supervision and intervention and divine providence. Because it's no coincidence. The same exact sin that they committed by drowning Jewish boys, that they suffered themselves, Yitro says, now I know that God is the ultimate and the only God. So, I want to explain to you a little deeper. Again, we can go a little deeper today on this subject. The rabbis of the Kabbalah explain that, of course, we know God is God. God is the omnipotent. God is the strongest. God controls everything. Even the angels, HaKadosh Baruch Hu controls them as well. And all the other spiritual forces, black magic, sorcery, and all these different forces, what there are forces in the world like that, but HaKadosh Baruch Hu controls all of them. And if he wants to stop them and suspend them and overpower them, he can at any moment. So the Mekubalim write that you have to know, if Paro was able to drown the Jewish boys in the water, that means at that point in history, he was using certain forces, forces of evil that were around at the time that allowed him to do such a thing. Which means you can't just do this at any given time. He must have looked in the stars and saw that that's the punishment that can be used at that given moment according to his usage of different, like I said, sorcery and black magic. So he used his forces to do what he did to the Jewish boys. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu specifically showed them, even your forces that you use, I control them. Those spiritual energies that you tapped into in order to do your decree, Paro, I'm above them. God is the ultimate spiritual force. And he used those forces against Paro himself. This subject of Midah Keneged Midah, measure for measure, that's the way God punishes people, that's the way God rewards people, incidentally. Person gets what he deserves both ways, both for the bad, and also both for the good. And the Gemara in Sanhedrin, and Daf Tzaddi says, there was a story in the Navi. There was a famine in Shomeron. Shomeron was one of the cities in Israel. And the people were starving, goes without saying. And Elisha Navi made a prediction, and he said, not only is the famine going to go away, there's going to be bounty, there's going to be plenty. It's going to be so bountiful that they're going to be selling a large quantity of wheat for a small amount of money, for a shekel, for a small amount of money. And the people accepted what Elisha said. Except one servant could not believe what Elisha was saying. How could it be? What do you mean? God's going to open up storehouses of food from the Shamayim and it's going to rain wheat? How's it? Today there's a famine. There's no food. Tomorrow it's going to be the opposite. There's going to be so much food that they're going to be giving it away. So the Eved did not accept the prophecy of Elisha. So the Navi tells him it's going to happen, like I said, but one thing's for sure, you're not going to benefit from it. And sure enough, the next day it happened. There was beracha, and there was an abundance amount of produce, and everybody was running into the city to get food. And what happened? This Eved, as he was running into the city, they trampled him to death, and he died. Exactly like the Navi said, that it's going to happen, but you're not going to benefit. Which means the Gemara is saying there's a measure for measure. You didn't believe in it? Good, so midah keneged midah. You didn't believe, you questioned the words of the prophet, now you're not going to benefit from the words of the prophet. You can't scoff at the prophet and mimic him and say, ah, it can't be, and then the next day go and enjoy it. There's a measure for measure. You second-guessed the veracity of the prophet Elisha, now you cannot enjoy from the beracha that Elisha brought down to the world. But I want to explain to you deeper how this works. When a prophet like Elisha makes a prediction, tomorrow there's going to be beracha, it's not just he's giving a forecast. It's not like Lavdila weatherman that says, you know, tomorrow it's going to be partly cloudy and it's going to rain and you're going to have snow, and he shows you an image and a view of some maps and things like that. No. The prophet is not just a forecaster. This is what I'm telling you now. The prophet himself becomes the tsinor, becomes the pipe, becomes the conduit where God sends the beracha down to the world through the prophet. Which means his being it himself is the link. He links himself to the Shekhinah, and now when God wants to bring down the beracha, it comes through the Navi into the world. So he's not just somebody telling you the news, current events, that tomorrow this is what's going to happen. He himself is the link, he's the conduit that allows it to go through him. And therefore, anybody that believes in the prophet, so you're connected to the pipe. So when it comes down to the pipe, if you're holding on to the pipe, you believe in the pipe, so you get a piece of it. But anybody that questions it and second guesses it and denies it, so you're separating yourself from the shefa, from the pipe. And therefore, when it comes down, but you're not holding on to it. You don't agree to it. You don't accept it. So therefore, when it comes down, you're removed. Person was minatik himself. He pulled himself away, so the beracha does not come. Why do I tell you this? Because it's the musar for us. Many times we read in Hazal, in the Gemariot, wherever it may be, that if a person does certain mitzvot, so those mitzvot bring a certain reward to the person. We read in the Mishnah in Pe'ah, Elu Devarim, She'adam Oseh Otam Ba'olam Hazeh. and he eats keren kayemet lo la'olam haba ve'ochem porotehem ba'olam hazeh. He eats the fruits, he reaps the fruits of certain mitzvot in this world, and the principle stands from in the next world. And the Mishnah lists, Havat shalom ben adam lechavero, a person that makes peace between two people that are fighting, or domestic tranquility, shalom bayit, he deals with, bikur cholim, machnasat orchim, person wakes up to the synagogue, gemilut hasadim, talmud torah, all these different mitzvot, there's a certain beracha. And we read many mitzvot that a person does. This mitzvah a person does gets long life, this person does, he gets beracha and parnasa. As the Gemara tells us, certain mitzvot bring certain real blessings. So we question, but how come we don't always see those blessings come true? So explanation is, according to what we're saying, it's possible that person, let's say, might have chas v'shalom, things that are blocking the beracha. Could be as averot, chas v'shalom, that block the beracha. Or he has, they'll get involved in Gilgul. Maybe something in a previous Gilgul is blocking it. But what the books bring down, I saw it wrote down, that if a person really believes in it, however, when he reads the statement, and it says if a person does this mitzvah, he's going to get the reward, if he believes in it, that means he's attaching himself to that mitzvah. Now the mitzvah, when it brings down the beracha, he's holding on to it like he's holding on to the Navi. Many times the reason why it doesn't come true is because you don't believe it. And therefore, because so it's like that story of Elisha. The guy doesn't believe it's going to happen. You don't believe it's going to happen. It's not going to happen. But when one clings on to the belief, that emunah and that emunah temimah, he clings on to that mitzvah and the beracha is able to come down. Therefore, a person should never be skeptical of these berachot that the rabbis tell us. And these promises that the Hakamim say, they happen, they come true. Sometimes it's interference, so they cannot come true. But if a person truly does it with simplicity, and without second-guessing it, and being skeptical, then the beracha will come down through the mitzvah. We read in our parasha about Matan Torah. The Jewish people received the Torah. Moshe Rabbeinu went up for 40 days and 40 nights to receive the Torah. The Midrash says, when Moshe Rabbeinu went up to God to receive the Torah, he saw a rabbi. He's going to live in the future. And this rabbi was sitting down and he was giving derashot. And the derashot were beyond human comprehension. He was being doresh, this rabbi, every single letter of the Torah, every single dot of the Torah, every single crown of the Torah. So Moshe Rabbeinu was so impressed. He saw such a scholar. He said, who's this man? So God tells him, this is Rabbi Akiva. He says, wow, Moshe Rabbeinu, I can't believe such a man, Rabbi Akiva, is such unbelievable derashot. God, I accept to resign. Let Rabbi Akiva give the Torah to the Jewish people. He's better than me. God said, keep quiet, shtok. I decided to choose you. Which is, God didn't argue with Moshe Rabbeinu that Rabbi Akiva wasn't great. He just said that my decision is that I want you to want to give the Torah. When we talk about Rabbi Akiva, we all know that Rabbi Akiva himself had 24,000 students. There was no rabbi that we read about that had such an impact and influence on Klal Yisrael. And after he lost his 24,000 students, they died tragically in a very short period of time, in about a month's time, a little more, they all passed away. He went again and opened up another yeshiva. And in this yeshiva he had five students. And from those five students, all the Torah that we have today, whether it's the Mishnah, whether it's the Gemara, all comes from those five students of Rabbi Akiva. And who were they? Rabbi Meir, famous Rabbi Meir, Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Elai, Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Ben Halafta, Rabbi Elazar Ben Shamua, and of course Rabbi Shimon Ben Yochai. Rashbi, these were all students of Rabbi Akiva, and from him comes all the Midrash, the Baraita, the Tosefta, the Zohar, the Kadosh, the Midrash, everything comes from those students. To show you how great, what type of Torah Rabbi Akiva had. The Gemara tells us in Berachot, the Romans made a decree that the Jewish people cannot study Torah. Rabbi Akiva defied that decree, and he went and he taught Torah in public. And they told him, Rabbi Akiva, what are you doing? So he gave them a mashal. He said, one time the fox went to the water. The fish was swimming in the water. So the fox tells the fish, listen, Why don't you come on dry land and live with me? At least you'll be saved from all the fishermen and their nets and things like this. So the fish told the sly fox, says, you're the one that they say is so smart, you're not so smart. Our habitat is in the water. That's where we belong. And if it's dangerous for us in the water where we belong, could you imagine how dangerous it's going to be for us on the land where we don't have an existence? Therefore, we'll stay in the water. Rabbi Akiva said, if I study, my habitat is Torah. My habitat, my environment, he said, is to learn Torah, to teach Torah. If you're going to tell me to stop teaching Torah, so you're going to put me in more danger. If in my habitat of learning Torah I'm in danger, or the most of you are going to tell me to close the books, he says, like a fish out of water, you're taking away my chiyut. And he went and he taught Torah barabim, and he was taken tortured by the Romans when they caught him. As you know, the story, and he died with the saying, Shema Yisrael, on his lips. Shema Yisrael, Shem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. Rabbi Akiva was Sadiq, Hasid, Kadosh. But I want you to know, as great as we're talking, he lived 120 years, full life, from the age of 40 until the age of 120, which means 80 years. Lo pasak pume megirsa. He did not stop one moment in studying Torah. Even when he studied for 24 years straight, he came home just to say hello to his wife after 12 years, and he heard his wife from the back say, well, if my husband wants to go back for another 12 years, I have no problem. He didn't even say hello to her. He went back to study. He didn't want to get caught up. Maybe she's going to tell him, do this, do that, stay home for a weekend. He went back to the yeshiva and studied some more. The tzedkut of Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef. We don't have a rabbi like this. But I want you to know, he wasn't always Rabbi Akiva ben Yosef. Before he became the great rabbi, till the age of 40, Rabbi Akiva was considered Am Haaretz. He was a worker. He worked for a wealthy man called Kalba Savua. And he did not have too much love to Tamidei Chachamim. Rabbi Akiva himself would say, when I was Am Haaretz and I would see a rabbi walking down the street, I said, me yitin, if God would give me the chance, I'd bite that rabbi like a hamor, like an ox, or like a donkey. So they said, Rabbi, why'd you say a donkey? He says, because a dog, he bites a superficial cut, bite. But when the hamor bites, he bites the bone. He gets the actual essence. That was Rabbi Akiva's attitude towards Tamidei Chachamim, before he was a Tamid Hacham. And you ask yourself, how was Rabbi Akiva able to make such a metamorphosis? Such a drastic change from Am Haaretz to Gadol HaDor, or even Moshe Rabbeinu, Alav HaShalom, looks at Rabbi Akiva and is impressed. So he says, the Mekubalim, the Arizal writes, there's no question, Rabbi Akiva had a tremendous neshama. He had one of the holiest neshamot that was ever brought down from the heavens. Rabbi Akiva possessed this neshama. But what? There was blockages. There was kilipot, there was a shell over the neshama of Rabbi Akiva. All he had to do was break that shell that was around his neshama, and now the neshama was able to shine. It's almost like a very bright, bright light, but somebody puts like a box over it, so you don't see the light. And all of a sudden you break the box, and all of a sudden, whoa, the light is able to shine. And therefore, the Rabbi Akiva, he just needed to push himself. He had it in him. But his wife, Rachel, who was a tzaddiket, pushed him, go learn. So he started. And all of a sudden, that thin or thick shell started to shed. And also, Rabbi Akiva's neshama was able to flourish. What do we learn from over here? That it's possible that all of us, nobody excluded, has tremendous neshama. Very high neshama, maybe great, great, great potential neshamot. And then we wonder, how come we're not reaching our aspirations? And we see some people that they have tremendous yearnings and dreams and aspirations. They want to accomplish, they want, that means they have a holy neshama. But what's holding them back? There's kilipot, there's a shell around it. And therefore a person has to push himself. When a person starts to push himself to start learning more Torah, to start doing more mitzvot, then, and he has to make exertion. You think it was so easy for the Rabbi Akiva to sit in first grade when he was 40 years old, he's learning alphabet with the kindergarten children? That was a big test for him. And then he has to sit in the first grade, in the second grade, in the third grade, and all the kids that he's walking, 45 year old man's walking with the third graders in the yeshiva. It's embarrassing. But he broke the kilipah, and look what he became. And therefore everybody has such a opportunity, but you just have to make an effort. And once you start to make an effort, then already the neshama is able to surge and reach its final, reach its potential. And some people, maybe they don't have such a high neshama, but the books bring down that if a person prays to Kadosh Baruch Hu, and he makes a tremendous effort to learn and pray, HaKadosh Baruch Hu sometimes will give him a new neshama. God takes away the old neshama and says, you know what? You have a zichut, here's a new neshama. And once a person gets the new neshama, he's able to reach the highest levels. And therefore, a person should know that a lot of times when these great tzaddikim accomplished all these things, is because they had holy neshamot. David HaMelech prayed, Lev tahor berali Elohim veruach nachon adish bekirbi. David prayed, give me a new soul, give me a new spirit. And God listened to him. God gave him a new spirit. And therefore, a person prays, take a little bit of who, please God, I want you to upgrade my neshama. I want you to give me a neshama tehora, give me a holy soul. That can already elevate a person to a high madrega. We said the other night, we know it's past, we spoke in a certain place, that sometimes it says in the holy books, when a person eats something, there's holiness in the food. There's spirituality in the food. The Mishnah Berurah brings it down from the Magen Avraham. That when a person eats many times, that holiness goes into his neshama. And if a person makes the right berachot on the food, and he says the Vrei Torah on the food, and he eats food that's kasher, that holiness goes into his neshama, and he becomes better because of it. And all of a sudden, a person wants to, he got inspired. All of a sudden, he feels like he wants to do more mitzvot. Where did this come from? It came from Sambusak. How did it come from a Sambusak? He made the beracha on it, he ate it b'kdusha, he ate it b'tahara, he made sure that it was kasher 100%. He made the proper kavanot, whatever it is, divrei Torah, he set on the table, it makes his soul better. And the opposite is also true. When a person eats food without berachot, chas v'shalom, there could be neshamot that are in the food of resha'im. And when a person eats food that's without a beracha, the neshamot of the resha'im, they go into him. And all of a sudden the person now becomes not religious. And he's wondering, what was the turning point? Where did I become that religious? Where did this start from? He doesn't realize because he wasn't making the proper berachot. And every time he ate something, that negativity went into his body. We learned about Yohanan Kohen Gadol. Yohanan was a great rabbi. More than a rabbi. Yohanan Kohen Gadol was Kohen Gadol. Holy Kohen. He went into the Holy of Holies 80 years. I have to tell you what that means, to walk into the Holy of Holies 80 years. You have to be a Kohen on the highest level, because Chas v'Shalom, if you have the wrong Kavanah, Chas v'Shalom, there's death. They used to put a rope on the Kohen Gadol's leg, that just in case he doesn't make it, they pull him out, because nobody can go in to take him. And what did the Jewish people do when the Kohen Gadol was in the Kodesh Kodashim? They would be praying. What are they praying for? Please, the Kadosh Baruch Hu, save the Kohen Gadol, that he shouldn't die. When the Kohen Gadol would come out of the Holy of Holies, he'd make a party. He would make a party for all his friends. He would have to say, Gomel, Birkat Gomel. He got saved from a dangerous situation. Yohanan walked into the Holy of Holies and walked out 80 times in a row. And then what happened in the 81st year? He became a Tzedduki. Tzedduki means he became a reformist. He became reform. The old days, the reform movement wasn't called the reform, it was called the Kanaim or the Tzedukim. And the Zohar, the Arizal asks, how? How did he go from Kohen Gadol to gangster? How did he go from the most religious person to become a bum? And the Arizal says, because he ate certain foods, and he didn't make the proper berachot on the foods, and he didn't say the Divrei Torah on the foods, and in those foods there was Rasha'im, and all of a sudden the Neshama of Rasha went into him, and as a result it just changed him. And all of a sudden he went from a religious man, all of a sudden he didn't know what happened, he just became... He became irreligious. So you see how important it is when we talk about making the berachot, these inyanim. And the opposite is also true. That a person makes the berachot the right way, good goes into this one and it inspires him. We said 2 weeks ago, a person gets angry, for example. Ka'az is the worst thing. The anger, the neshama leaves him. Now, God takes away his neshama, puts another neshama instead. What type of neshama does he get? Could be had a good one. Now they reversed it, they take the good one, they give him who knows what. Therefore, the Arizal said the main thing a person has to keep away from is ka'as. I told you, when the people go to the mikveh, the first thing that they, when they dip in the mikveh, what's the first thing they think of? Tikkun ha-ka'as. Please, God, forgive me for the sin of ka'as. That's what the holy books bring down. Good. We go a little further. In the Ten Commandments, we're reading this week's parasha, just to review a few of them. The hardest mitzvah of the Ten Commandments undoubtedly is Kabed et abicha ve et imecha, honor your parents. This is a very difficult mitzvah. The mitzvah of honoring parents is not as long as the parents are alive. It's as long as the child is alive. That means children have to honor their parents not only when they're alive, but even after the parents pass away, the children still have to respect. And some will argue that the main respect that a child does to the parents is after the parent passes away. Because in this world, you can benefit your parents physically. Give them a glass of water, talk nicely to them, listen to their words, but that's all temporary. But after they pass away, a child is able to benefit his parents eternally. Now already you can give your parents olam haba. That's the biggest favor a child could do for the parents. You can elevate their souls in the eternal world. And there's a book called Sefer Haredim. He writes that when the child respects his parents, he must respect them b'ma'aseh, b'divur, b'machshava. Indeed, in speech and in thought. Indeed, that means you feed them. Unfortunately, parents get older. They can't eat anymore by themselves. They need their children to take care of them. Even such basic things like eating and taking care of their bodily needs, yeah, they lose their ability. Chas v'shalom, a parent, which we can't imagine, regresses. And the parent now becomes like a child that cannot do anything on its own. Therefore, the children, they go and they do all these mitzvot for them. That's the first thing, b'maaseh, b'dibur. When the children talk to the parents, they talk with such respect and humility. The books bring down, I'm saying something that's funny to say in our generation, that a child should talk to his parents like they're talking to a king. We don't have this over here today. The opposite. The parents talk to the children like they're the children are the kings. We're scared of our children. But in the olden days, this is the way it was with the dibur, that the children had a certain kavod. There was one great rabbi. He was on a trip. He was sitting in a carriage of horses. I think he was in one of them, and his mother was in a different carriage, on the same caravan. So the rabbi was hungry, so he took out his food, made the shadaim, he ate. So when they finally got off the caravan, they got to the place. He was full, the rabbi, just ate. His mother tells him, "My dear son, you're probably very hungry, go eat something." So he went, he made the shadaim, he ate. So he said, "Hakam, you just ate on the..." He said, "My mother told me to eat. I can't argue with her. I don't have the ability." He's full. He said, "I don't have the ability to tell her that I ate already." There's a certain kavod. You can tell a queen or a king, "I ate already." He can't even answer them. That's the sensitivity that they had. I saw a story on this subject of kibud abayim and in yanav the neshamot. And b'dibu em machshava. Machshava means in thought. The person has to think only the highest thoughts about his parents. That his parents are precious and special and they're important, and they're the thoughts even that the child has to have are positive about his parents. So I saw a story. One time there was a great rabbi giving shi'ur. It was a shi'ur gemara, and there were boys sitting in the shi'ur, and the rabbi asked a certain question to the boys, and they were all thinking and analyzing. It was a very deep question. In the interim, as everybody was looking for the answer, one of the boys said to himself, "You know what? I didn't have lunch yet. I'm going to run home. Because now they're not learning. Now they're just trying to figure out the answer to the question. So I'm going to run home for a couple of minutes. I'll get something to eat." Because he lived right around the yeshiva. "And I'll run back, to hear the answer." He runs home, eats a quick lunch. He's ready to leave. His mother says, "Do me a favor. In the attic, I have some stuff. Could you please bring it down?" So the kid says, "Ma, I'm in the middle of shi'ur. I just came home for a minute to eat something. Are you going to make me now go to the attic and bring this stuff? Please, I can't do it. I got to go back to the yeshiva." So he goes back to yeshiva. On the way back, he says to himself, "What am I doing over here? What am I studying for? The only reason why you study is so you can, when you have a chance to do a mitzvah, you do the mitzvah. Now I have a chance to respect my mother. I'm not going to respect my mother." He went back. He went back and says, "Ma, what do you want me to do?" Upstairs, he does whatever he does, fine. Now all of a sudden, he comes back to the yeshiva. He comes back to the yeshiva. The rabbi sees him. He stands up. The boy doesn't understand it. "Are you standing up for me, the rabbi? I can't understand it." And then the rabbi says, "This question that we had in the shiur today that nobody can answer, I'm going to give you the answer now." And he gives him a brilliant answer. So the rabbi gave the answer. So he says, "I'm going to tell you who told me this answer. The great rabbi of the Gemara, Abaye." Abaye, his name is on almost every page of the Gemara. "Abaye came to me and gave me this answer." "Abaye? Where did Abaye come to you?" He said, "You see this boy over here? This boy went home and he respected his mother." He says, At that moment when he respected his mother, the neshama of Abaye came down into this boy. And when he came back to the yeshiva, he came back with the neshama of Abaye. And Abaye gave me the answer to the question. So he says, why? Why did Abaye come? Because Abaye was a yatom. Abaye did not have parents. Abaye rashi tevot asher becha yiruham yatom. That's what they called him, Abaye. He was a yatom. He wasn't able to fulfill the mitzvah. He says, when this young boy was doing the mitzvah, Abaye was in the neshamah. He wanted to be part of this mitzvah that he could never fulfill. So he attached himself to the neshamah of this boy so he could be part of the mitzvah of kibud, after he was never able to fulfill the respecting of his mother. And once already the neshamah went in, look, the boy, he says he's a different boy, this child. So you see, when a person does a mitzvah, all of a sudden the neshamah of a tzaddik attaches. You did one deed. Now all of a sudden he's walking around the neshamah of Abaye in him. You know what type of kiddusha that is? So we can't understand it. But the rabbi said, I stand up for it. I he saw it with his own eyes. To show you over here how far a person has to go when it comes to mitzvah of kibud av v'em. There's another mitzvah in the Ten Commandments. The mitzvah of lo tignob. What is lo tignob?
Don't steal.
Good. Really, it doesn't mean don't steal. In the Ten Commandments, lo tignob is do not kidnap. You see, all the Ten Commandments, at least the last ones, lo tirsach, do not murder, lo tanaf, do not commit adultery, these are sins that are punishable by death. Person murders, he's punishable by death. Person commits adultery, he's punishable by death. So the Gemara, when it says lo tignov, it's not talking about monetary stealing. Monetary stealing is not punishable by death. It's talking about kidnapping. Somebody takes somebody and calls him in captivity, this is already lo tignov. But there's another pasuk in the Torah, lo tignobu. That's a parashat kedoshim. Lo tignobu means do not steal monetarily. So both things are asud. Kidnapping a person and a monetary stealing. On this subject, I saw from the great Sadiq Rav Pam alav Shalom, where he's talking about the isud of stealing money. He brings out a few examples which I'm sure most people are not aware of, that is considered asur from the halakha. Not only robbing a bank, we know that already. Not only being a kleptomaniac, going into a store and stealing food, putting it in your pocket, we know that already. But he comes along the rabbi and he brings it down that even stealing for fun is asur. What's for fun? Now, generation, everybody likes to do pranks. Everybody likes to prank each other and trick each other and make games on each other. So Rav Pam brings down. The boys are sitting down in the shi'ur, whatever it is, and the guy puts his cell phone on the table, yeah, like everybody does. Then he goes out to the bathroom for a minute. One guy takes his cell phone, puts it in his pocket. He wants to prank him. Now he comes back. Hey, where's my phone? Where's my phone gone? Everybody's laughing at him. This guy over here doesn't know where he put his phone. So they're tricking him. And he goes around, he's looking, what I put, he goes back to the bathroom, he's looking, he can't know where his phone is. Finally, when he goes outside, the guy takes the phone out, he puts it back. He says, hey, yeah, boy, it's right over here in front of you. He says, oh, I don't believe it, I didn't see it over here. Rapam says, asur, it's gezer, that's considered stealing. What do you mean stealing? I was joking around. He said, it doesn't matter. Even stealing for fun, according to the halakha, asur, it's forbidden. Oh, so that case, I can understand, because you're hurting the guy also. But then he brings another case, which I'm shocked that he brings it, but he says it's the Rambam Shita. He says, according to Rambam, the next case is forbidden from the rabbis, and according to Sifra the Hainuk, it's forbidden from the Torah. What's the case? You have a child, he's playing with a toy. Like the children, always playing with toys. So an adult comes along, and he takes the toy, and he puts it in his hand. And the child says, give me the toy back. And he goes to get it, and then the guy puts it in his left hand. And then he goes to his left hand, he puts it in his right hand. He goes like this a couple of times back and forth. He's tricking the child. And the child starts to cry. Quote al-Halakha says that's asur. That's also considered you're stealing from the child, Chas v'Shalom, which is an amazing, amazing thing. Who does? Everybody does this. You're playing with the kid. But that's considered. You do it all the time, okay? Don't do it anymore. So now you see over here, the Inyan, how far it goes. We're stopping all the fun. No more fun. That's it. No more fun. But not at somebody else's expense. That's the point. The point is, he brings another case, which is the biggest chiddush. The biggest chiddush is like this. A parent, he writes, that let's say the child is careless. The child is careless with his stuff and whatever it is. He leaves things and he forgets and stuff like that, like most children. You know, they're not careful with their stuff. So the parent wants to teach the kid a lesson. Now, so the kid has his, whatever it is, his ball, whatever he's playing with, he leaves it over there, and the parent knows. He's going to leave it there, he's going to forget it. So the parent comes and takes it, and where's the ball? I don't know, where is it? Here it is, and then he takes it out after. That's also, even though you're teaching your child a lesson, but not through this this method. So goes, what are we showing you? Rapam wants to show you how sensitive the Torah's understanding of stealing is. But he goes a little further. Not only stealing monetarily, says the great rabbi, even stealing genevat da'at, which is even tricking somebody, causing somebody to think something that's not true. The Gemara tells a story. The Gemara tells a story in Hulin, Daf Sadi Dalet. There was a rabbi called Mursutra. Mursutra was traveling from a place called Sichra to Be Mechuzah. When he was traveling, all of a sudden he sees two great rabbis, Rava and Rav Safra, they're coming to greet him. Oh, so Mursutra comes off the carriage that he was on, says, wow, Skil Mitzvot, thank you, you came to greet me, I appreciate it, Skil Mitzvot, you didn't have to. So Rava says, don't worry, we didn't. So what do you mean you didn't? He says, we weren't coming to greet you, we were on the way to Be Mechuzah, or to Sichra, we were going the other way. So happened to be, we saw you, but if we would have known that you were coming, we would have went to greet you. So the rabbi, Rav Safra, tells Rava, what did you tell him that for? He says, because I don't want him to think that it's not true. We weren't coming to greet him. So the rabbi told him back, you didn't have to say anything. So the rabbis learn that in this case, he didn't have to say anything. Why? Because Morsutra tricked himself. They didn't trick him, they didn't say anything. He offered the information. He said, oh, thank you for coming to greet me. In that case, they didn't have to tell him we didn't come to greet you, because it's going to cause him, it's going to make him embarrassed, it's going to make him feel bad. The rabbi, though, they felt, no, I got to be honest, I don't want him to think that we did something that we didn't do. He's giving us credit for something we didn't deserve. There the Gemara says, you don't have to tell, because he initiated it. He made the mistake. You didn't tell him, oh, rabbi, we came to greet you. That's already asur. You're lying to him. You want him to think that you were giving them respect. That's forbidden. But to come along and when he made the mistake, and if you're going to reveal it, you're going to embarrass him. So the Gemara says, okay, so Rapam tells a story about his mother. His mother was known to be a great tzaddik and very a stickler when it came to telling the truth. So what happened? It says Rapam, when his parents were still living in Europe, his father decided to go to America to make some money and then send it back to Europe to bring the family over. So when the rabbi's father, Rapam, his father was Rabbi Meir, went to America. So a lady came to the Rebbetzin, to Rapam's mother, and said, please, I know your husband, he's a respectable rabbi, he's in America now. Please, could you tell him to send a letter to my uncle? So she said, who's your uncle? He's a very rich man that lives in America. And if your husband will write a letter, maybe he'll send us some money, because we don't have any money, and you know he doesn't send us anything. But if your husband, he's in America already, let him send a letter to our uncle, that we know he knows the family, and so on and so forth. So Rapam's wife felt that this was a very tall order. This is a hard request, number one, because she doesn't even give her the address where the guy lives, what the uncle's name is. How's my husband going to find your uncle? America's a big country. They write him a letter from nowhere. She didn't think that there was feasible. She didn't say anything. She said, we'll see. What happened? Eventually, that lady that came to ask for that request died. So Rapam's wife went to be Menachem Avil. She goes to the Ni'um Avilim. So the children get up to greet Rapam's wife. Thank you, thank you. Thank you for what? Because of your husband's letter? Our uncle sent us a large sum of money, and Baruch Hashem, we're comfortable, we have to thank you. So Rapam's mother says, Mechila, I never told my husband. He never wrote the letter. And they were dumbfounded. She said, God was good to you. God put it in the mind of your uncle to send you the money on his own, but it wasn't me. So Rapam says, his mother regretted that, which she did for the rest of her life. Because even though she wanted to be honest, she felt that maybe she was too honest and embarrassed. And based on the Gemara that we just learned, she didn't initiate it. They made the mistake. They came along and said, thank you very much. She, in that case, could have kept quiet and said,
You're welcome. She didn't have to say anything because by saying something, she caused them to say, but what do you see from here? That the Torah is so careful in even misleading somebody. I said one time, even happens a lot, you know a person's going away. You know already, they're traveling, you heard from somebody else. So you go to them, please, I want you to eat over Shabbat, come to me Shabbat. No, I'm going to be away. Oh, you're going to be away, I'm sorry. Okay, next time. You knew they're going to be away. So, but what? You're trying to trick them. You're trying to, now they owe you. Now they, oh, thank you very much, please, no, don't think of it. You know they're not going to be there. So then you're fooling them. You're making that, you knew they're going to be away. So what are you inviting them for? Because you just want them to owe you a favor and things like this. So a person to be very, that's already Geneva. See, the Torah's level of stealing is on such a very high madriga. Last but not least, there's much to say in the Parasha, but today is a very significant day for two reasons. Today is the 70th day of Shabbat. 70th day of Shabbat, we commemorate two things. 400 years ago, in Spain, in the city called Saragossa, there was a miracle that happened to the Jews, and as a result, every year on this day, the Jews of Spain would read the Megillah. Megillat Esther on this day because a miracle happened where the whole Jewish community was saved. And they would say Hallel, it was a big thing, it was a miracle. What happened? Purim, they called it Purim Saragossa, the Purim of Saragossa, Spain. What happened? The king at the time was Alfonso. Every time Alfonso would come visit that city, they would greet him by taking all the Sefarim out of the Hechal, and they would go and put like a parade of all the Sefre Kodesh, and to greet the king. It was a big pageantry and honor. What happened? The rabbis of Spain decided it's not kavod for the Sefer Torah to take it out to greet a king.
It's a goy.
So what they do? They decided just to take out the cases. They're not going to take out the Sefer Torah scrolls themselves. They took the scrolls out of the... And they're just going to bring the case. He doesn't look inside anyway. It's kavod. So what happened? They found out that the king was coming. So a couple of days before, the Shemosh went to the Bet Knesset, and he took out all the scrolls from the Sefer Torah. Very good. There was an informer, a Moser, Jewish man. He went to the king Alfonso. He said, what do you think? He says, these Jews, they're making fun of you. So what are you talking about? He said, they take out the Sefer. He says, it's hollow. It's an empty case they're taking out. They're making jokes from you. So what are you talking about? He said, did you ever look inside when they took it? I said, I didn't even think to look inside. Sefer Torah. He says, nah, there's nothing inside. And the next day, the king is planning on coming to visit. And already the Shamosh took out all the scrolls from the Sefer Torah. And Chas v'Shalom, it could be very dangerous. That night, the rabbi of the city had a dream. In his dream, he sees the Beit Knesset is on fire. The synagogue's burning. It's on flames, engulfed. He got scared. In the middle of the night, 2 o'clock in the morning, he wakes up, he wants to go see the Knis. He calls the Shamosh, come, open up the Knis, we have to see what's going on. They go into the Knis, they see nothing, everything's fine. He's impossible. Hashem showed me this dream for a reason. There's danger in the synagogue. Open the Hechal. They open the Hechal, he says, we made a mistake. We have to put the Sefer Torah back in these cases over here. They put the Sefer Torah back in the cases, they close it. The next day, Alfonso comes to town. They bring the Sefer Torah out, they're dancing, they're singing, Alfonso says, open the cases. Now everybody's scared because they know that the Shamosh took them out, except the rabbi knows. They open the cases, they see the Sefer Torah. The king comes on and says, this Rasha, he tried to get the Jewish people in trouble, he lied to me, they hung him, they killed him on the spot. And the Jewish people were saved, they had tremendous, tremendous miracles. The day that was destined for them to Chas v'Shalom, to turn into a great tragedy, La'yudim hayta ora v'simcha v'zason v'nahafuchu. That it turned around. That the day that was supposed to be Avelut for them turned into the day of Sasum V'Simcha. So this is the 70th day of Shabbat, is a commemoration of that great miracle that took place to the Jews of Spain. But it also commemorates the Yortzeit of the great Tzaddik that we talked about last week, Rabbeinu Chaim Palachi, alav shalom. Rabbeinu Chaim Palachi, the chief rabbi of Izmir, Turkey, of about 250 years ago. Rabbi Chaim was not only a great Tzaddik, but a prolific writer. He wrote over 72, repeat, he didn't write, he wrote many Sefarim. It was published over 72 Sefarim. There was a great fire that took place in Izmir that burnt the whole Jewish neighborhood and burnt also a lot of the rabbi's books. 52 of the rabbi's books that he wrote were burnt. And the rabbi got sick because of that. But Baruch Hashem, he recovered, and he led the community in Izmir, Turkey, and the whole community for many years. He lived till 80 years old, and it was a tremendous, tremendous writer, as I said, Gaon. Even the Ashkenazim, when they would send letters to him, they would refer to him, the Malbim, for example. The great Rabbi Malbim would send letters to the Chaim Palachi, would call him Sabaka Disha, Ish Gadot, Sadiq. They would all give him the greatest accolades. So I just want to quote one word of Musar that Rav Chaim Palachi writes in his Sefer, Sava'a Mechayim. That in the Zichut that we learned this in his name today, the Zichut of Tzaddik will Yagen Ba'adenu Amen. Hachamim say, whenever you quote a Tzaddik, Seftotav Dovevot Bekever, the Tzaddik's mouth moves in the grave when you're saying the Devei Torah that he said. So we have a zechut also to me'orer the rachamim on the day of his yotzei. He writes, "Sarich la'achmir arbe me'od b'netilat shadayim shacharit." When it comes to making tilat shadayim in the morning, to be very careful. "Shichmiru arbe me'od b'zor hakadosh ki aolech arba amot b'din tilat shadayim hayav mita." Chas v'shalom, a person goes, walks 4 amot, 6 steps without tilat shadayim, the zohar is very strict. Hayav mita. That's why a lot of people, they put the Netilat Yadayim right next to their bed. Some people, when they build their homes, they build a sink right next to their bed. When they wake up in the morning, they make. Some people, they have to walk. They're far away. So the rabbi says, you walk 2 steps, you stop. You walk 2 steps, you stop. So you shouldn't have to walk 4 amot in 1 shot. And then he comes along and says, not only that, but you have to be careful when Netilat Yadayim of the Seuda. Before a person eats bread, he has to make the Netilat Yadayim. Chas v'shalom, the Gemara he brings, says that if a person is not careful on the Netilat Yadayim before he has bread, it brings chasom aniyut. Ani rashe tevot al Netilat Yadayim. That if a person doesn't make the Netilat Yadayim before bread, chas v'shalom, and the opposite is true also, 500 more times. If a person is careful to make the Netilat Yadayim before he eats bread, he gets rich. Mayim rashe tevot male yadenu mebirchotecha. To fulfill my hands with your blessings. That's why the Gemara says that Chizda used to fill the cup up to the top and it would overflow. And he became rich. What are you doing, Rabbi? He says, because I use a lot of water for Netilat Yadayim, they gave me a lot of beracha. But the opposite is true. If a person is not careful in Netilat Yadayim, he doesn't get the beracha as well. And then he reminds us of all the different times a person has to clean his hands. You know, being a religious Jew is like being like a doctor. The hands always have to be sterile. They always have to be prepared to serve God. And the following things he writes from Shulchan Aruch, you need Netilat Yadayim. Elu devarim sedikim Netilat Yadayim b'mayim. Hakam mamita. Person wakes up. Not only in the morning. In the morning, for sure, then you have to make the Netilat Yadayim b'sirugin like this, alternating with a beracha. But even a person rests in the afternoon, let's say. He lies down for 15, 20 minutes. When he wakes up, you also have to make the Netilat Yadayim without a beracha. Then he says, Hayosim b'tekiseh. Person leaves the bathroom. Not only when he leaves the bathroom where he relieved himself, even just walking into the bathroom, where the Beit Kiseh is, person has to come out and he has to wash his hands. So many people, they build their bathrooms, they build the washroom outside. So it's separate. So therefore, because if it's in the same room, they have to... So Al-Kham Avadiyah writes that if you wash your hands in the bathroom, in the same room, and you dry them outside, it's okay. If you dry them outside. But a lot of times, person goes to the bathroom, to bathe the kids, or to get something, and so on and so forth. So really, according to the halakha, person has to wash his hands. Person goes, comes out of the mikveh. Netilat Yadayim. Person cuts his nails. Netilat Yadayim. Person touches his shoes. Shower? No. Depending if it's in the bathroom. But a person has to cut his nails. Netilat Yadayim. Or person scratches. The only time you make a beracha is when you're washing for bread, or when you're doing it in the morning. All these other times, beli beracha. Person takes a haircut, has to make Netilat Yadayim. Person scratches his head, Netilat Yadayim. Bar minan, a person goes to the cemetery, meshamesh mitato, or he touches parts of his body that's uncovered, scratches his back, let's say, where he touches parts of the body, puts his finger in his ear. Also, it's a place that's covered on his nose. After shalom, the person has to make Netilat Yadayim itself. And the Gemara and the halakha writes, im tamir hachamu, if he's a tamid hacham and doesn't be not careful, talmudo mishtakeya, he forgets his learning. V'im eno tamid hacham, if he's not a tamid hacham, yotze medato, he goes out of his mind. And therefore, the rabbi says, so many people are not careful. They take off their shoes with their hands.
Now that only just once, could it be? I saw rabbis do after that just like
That's fine. Even yes, that's fine. Even coming out of the bathroom, if a person just washes, puts his hand under the water, it's also okay. The main times that he needs to do the sirugim is when he wakes up in the morning and when he is making fetch adayim, he needs the course. The other times, no, but if a person wants to be strict, it's better to use a course in all these cases, especially like I said, when he's cut, after he cuts his nails, haircuts, the Alechem cemetery.
Going back to see.
I'm not. I'll say the Charav, ladies, I'm not a posik. You'll go ask your rabbis what to do. I'm just giving you examples so you'd be aware of it. But touching your shoes is very common. Person goes home, have boots. Person wears boots. You can't take off your boots unless you touch them. Person takes off the boots. Now wants to have a glass of water. You cannot make shakon yawet baro. Because you didn't make the tirat shadayim. And therefore you have to wash your hands after you touch your shoes. It happens many times in the synagogue. A person's praying and he's sitting with his hands like this. He doesn't realize his hands are touching his shoes. And he's praying. Not only from the cleanliness, from the halakha standpoint, there's tum'ah on the shoes. Because you're stepping on the ground. And therefore, a person has to be very careful to the children also. They touch their shoes, you have to make them wash their hands. They're involved cutting their nails, you have to wash their hands after this. But it's, if a person doesn't do it, you see what the consequences are.
What about in a shoe store?
Shoe store, no, they're new shoes. New shoes, you don't have to. It means shoes that are shoes that you wore already outside. But if the new shoes that were just worn in the shoe store, it's not a problem. It's a good question. The poskim asked this question. In any event, ladies, the lesson over here is that you need kiddushah. And where's the kiddushah? The kiddushah is in the yadayim. Then when a person's kiddushah in the yadayim, then all the mitzvot that he does brings kiddushah into a person. Bar menanas, if a doctor does the operation without washing his hands, sakana. When a person's involved in mitzvot, it's also an operation. It's a spiritual operation. Therefore, his hands have to be prepared. The rabbi says that he has a tradition. That anybody that's careful to wash his hands at all these times, he'll never be lacking water. Even in time where there'll be a drought or the pipes don't work, there'll always be water for this person over and there'll be beracha. So in the zechut that we mentioned, one word from Rav Chaim Palachi, zechut ha-tzadik, again, aleinu, v'al kol amo Yisrael, amen.